7, January 1975. Todd left school by himself after the last bell, got his bike, and pedaled down to the park. He found a deserted bench, set his Schwinn up on its kickstand, and took his report card out of his hip pocket. He took a look around to see if there was anyone in the area he knew, but the only other people in sight were two high school kids making out by the pond and a pair of gross-looking winos passing a paper bag back and forth. Dirty fucking winos, he thought. But it wasn't the winos that had upset him. He opened his card. English, C. American History, C. Earth Science, D. Your community and you, B. Primary French, F. Beginning algebra, F. He stared at the grades, unbelieving. He had known it was going to be bad, but this was disaster. Maybe that's best, an inner voice spoke up suddenly. Maybe you even did it on purpose because a part of you wants it to end, needs for it to end, before something bad happens. He shoved the thought roughly aside. Nothing bad was going to happen. Dusander was under his thumb, totally under his thumb. The old man thought one of Todd's friends had a letter, but he didn't know which friend. If anything happened to Todd, anything, that letter would go to the police. Once he supposed Dusander might have tried it anyway. Now he was too old to run, even with a head start. He's under control, damn it, Todd whispered, and then pounded his thigh hard enough to make the muscle knot. Talking to yourself was bad shit. Crazy people talk to themselves. He had picked up the habit over the last 6 weeks or so and didn't seem able to break it. He'd caught several people looking at him strangely because of it. A couple of them had been teachers, and that asshole Bernie Everson had come right out and asked him if he was going fruit crackers. Todd had come very, very close to punching the little pansy in the mouth, and that sort of stuff, brawl, scuffles, punch-outs, was no good. That sort of stuff got you noticed in all the wrong ways. Talking to yourself was bad, right, okay, but the dreams are bad too, he whispered. He didn't catch himself that time. Just lately, the dreams had been very bad. In the dreams, he was always in uniform, although the type varied. Sometimes it was a paper uniform, and he was standing in line with hundreds of gaunt men. The smell of burning was in the air, and he could hear the choppy roar of bulldozer engines. Then Dusander would come up the line, pointing out this one or that one. They were left. The others were marched away toward the crematoriums. Some of them kicked and struggled, but most were too undernourished, too exhausted. Then Dusander was standing in front of Todd. Their eyes met for a long, paralyzing moment, and then Dusander leveled a faded umbrella at Todd. "Take this one to the laboratories," Dusander said in the dream. His lip curled back to reveal his false teeth. "Take this American boy." In another dream, he wore an SS uniform. His jackboots were shined to a mirror-like reflecting surface. The death's head insignia and the lightning bolts glittered. But he was standing in the middle of Santo Donato Boulevard, and everyone was looking at him. They began to point. Some of them began to laugh. Others looked shocked, angry, or revolted. In this dream, an old car came to a squalling, creaky halt, and Dusander peered out at him, a Dusander who looked 200 years old and nearly mummified, his skin a yellowed scroll. "I know you," the dream Dusander proclaimed shrilly. He looked around at the spectators and then back to Todd. "You were in charge at Patton. Look, everybody. This is the blood fiend of Patton, Himmler's efficiency expert. I denounce you, murderer. I denounce you, butcher. I denounce you, killer of infants. I denounce you." In yet another dream, he wore a striped convict's uniform and was being led down a stone-walled corridor by two guards who looked like his parents. Both wore conspicuous yellow armbands with the Star of David on them. Walking behind them was a minister, reading from the Book of Deuteronomy. Todd looked back over his shoulder and saw that the minister was Dusander, and he was wearing the black tunic of an SS officer. At the end of the stone corridor, double doors opened on an octagonal room with glass walls. There was a scaffold in the center of it. Behind the glass walls stood ranks of emaciated men and women, all naked, all watching with the same dark, flat expression. On each arm was a blue number. "It's all right," Todd whispered to himself. "It's okay, really. Everything's under control." A couple that had been making out glanced over at him. Todd stared at them fiercely, daring them to say anything. At last they looked back the other way. Had the boy been grinning? Todd got up, jammed his report card into his hip pocket, and mounted his bike. He pedaled down to a drugstore 2 blocks away. There he bought a bottle of ink eradicator and a fine point pen that dispensed blue ink. He went back to the park. The make-out couple was gone, but the winos were still there, stinking the place up, and changed his English grade to a B, American history to A, earth science to B, primary French to C, and beginning algebra to B. Your community and you, he eradicated and then simply wrote in again, so the card would have a uniform look. Uniforms, right. "Never mind," he whispered to himself. "That'll hold them. That'll hold them, all right." One night late in the month, sometime after 2 o'clock, Kurt Dusander awoke, struggling with the bedclothes, gasping and moaning, into a darkness that seemed close and terrifying. He felt half suffocated, paralyzed with fear. It was as if a heavy stone lay on his chest, and he wondered if he could be having a heart attack. He clawed in the darkness for the bedside lamp and almost knocked it off the nightstand, turning it on. "I'm in my own room," he thought. "My own bedroom. Here in Santo Donato, here in California, here in America. See, the same brown drapes pulled across the same window, the same bookshelves filled with dime paperbacks from the bookshop on Soren Street. Same gray rug, same blue wallpaper. No heart attack. No jungle. No eyes." But the terror still clung to him, like a stinking pelt, and his heart went on racing. The dream had come back. He had known that it would, sooner or later, if the boy kept on. The cursed boy. He thought the boy's letter of protection was only a bluff, and not a very good one at that, something he had picked up from the TV detective programs. What friend would the boy trust not to open such a momentous letter? No friend, that was who. Or so he thought. If he could be sure. His hands closed with an arthritic, painful snap, and then opened slowly. He took the packet of cigarettes from the table and lit one, scratching the wooden match on the bedpost. The clock's hand stood at 2:41. There would be no more sleep for him this night. He inhaled smoke and then coughed it out in a series of racking spasms. No more sleep, unless he wanted to go downstairs and have a drink or two, or three. And there had been altogether too much drinking over the last 6 weeks or so. He was no longer a young man who could toss them off one after the other, the way he had when he had been an officer on leave in Berlin in 39, when the scent of victory had been in the air, and everywhere you heard the Führer's voice, saw his blazing, commanding eyes. The boy, the cursed boy. "Be honest," he said aloud, and the sound of his own voice in the quiet room made him jump a little. He was not in the habit of talking to himself, but neither was it the first time he had ever done so. He remembered doing it off and on during the last few weeks at Patin, when everything had come down around their ears, and in the east the sound of Russian thunder grew louder, first every day and then every hour. It had been natural enough to talk to himself then. He had been under stress, and people under stress often do strange things, cup their testicles through the pockets of their pants, click their teeth together. Wolf had been a great teeth clicker. He grinned as he did it. Hoffman had been a finger snapper and a thigh patter, creating fast, intricate rhythms that he seemed utterly unaware of. He, Kurt Dusander, had sometimes talked to himself. But now, "You are under stress again," he said aloud. He was aware that he had spoken in German this time. He hadn't spoken German in many years. But the language now seemed warm and comfortable. It lulled him, eased him. It was sweet and dark. "Yes, you are under stress because of the boy. But be honest with yourself. It is too early in the morning to tell lies. You have not entirely regretted talking. At first you were terrified that the boy could not or would not keep his secret. He would have to tell a friend, who would tell another friend, and that friend would tell too. But if he has kept it this long, he will keep it longer. If I am taken away, he loses his talking book. Is that what I am to him? I think so." He fell silent, but his thoughts went on. He had been lonely. No one would ever know just how lonely. There had been times when he thought almost seriously of suicide. He made a bad hermit. The voices he heard came from the radio. The only people who visited were on the other side of a dirty glass square. He was an old man, and although he was afraid of death, he was more afraid of being an old man who was alone. His bladder sometimes tricked him. He would be halfway to the bathroom when a dark stain spread on his pants. In wet weather, his joints would first throb and then begin to cry out, and there had been days when he had chewed an entire tin of arthritis pain formula between sunrise and sunset, and still the aspirin only subdued the aches. Even such acts as taking a book from the shelf or switching the TV channel became an essay in pain. His eyes were bad. Sometimes he knocked things over, barked his shins, bumped his head. He lived in fear of breaking a bone and not being able to get to the telephone. And he lived in fear of getting there and having some doctor uncover his real past as he became suspicious of Mr. Denker's non-existent medical history. The boy had alleviated some of those things. When the boy was here, he could call back the old days. His memory of those days was perversely clear. He spilled out a seemingly endless catalogue of names and events, even the weather of such and such a day. He remembered Private Henried, who manned a machine gun in the northeast tower, and the wen Private Henried had between his eyes. Some of the men called him Three Eyes, or Old Cyclops. He remembered Kessel, who had a picture of his girlfriend naked, lying on a sofa with her hands behind her head. Kessel charged the men to look at it. He remembered the names of the doctors and their experiments, thresholds of pain, the brain waves of dying men and women, physiological retardation, effects of different sorts of radiation, dozens more, hundreds more. He supposed he talked to the boy as all old men talk. But he guessed he was luckier than most old men, who had impatience, disinterest, or outright rudeness for an audience. His audience was endlessly fascinated. Were a few bad dreams too high a price to pay? He crushed out his cigarette, lay looking at the ceiling for a moment, and then swung his feet out onto the floor. He and the boy were loathsome, he supposed, feeding off each other, eating each other. If his own belly was sometimes sour with the dark but rich food they partook of in his afternoon kitchen, what was the boy's like? Did he sleep well? Perhaps not. Lately, Dusander thought the boy looked rather pale and thinner than when he had first come into Dusander's life. He walked across the bedroom and opened the closet door. He brushed hangers to the right, reached into the shadows, and brought out the sham uniform. It hung from his hand like a vulture skin. He touched it with his other hand, touched it, and then stroked it. After a very long time, he took it down and put it on, dressing slowly, not looking into the mirror until the uniform was completely buttoned and belted, and the sham fly zipped. He looked at himself in the mirror then, and nodded. He went back to bed, lay down, and smoked another cigarette. When it was finished, he felt sleepy again. He turned off the bed lamp, not believing it, that it could be this easy. But he was asleep 5 minutes later, and this time his sleep was dreamless. 8. February 1975. After dinner, Dick Bowden produced a cognac that Dusander privately thought dreadful. But of course he smiled broadly and complimented it extravagantly. Bowden's wife served the boy a chocolate malted. The boy had been unusually quiet all through the meal. Uneasy? Yes. For some reason the boy seemed very uneasy. Dusander had charmed Dick and Monica Bowden from the moment he and the boy had arrived. The boy had told his parents that Mr. Denker's vision was much worse than it actually was, which made poor old Mr. Denker in need of a seeing-eye dog, Dusander thought dryly, because that explained all the reading the boy had supposedly been doing. Dusander had been very careful about that, and he thought there had been no slips. He was dressed in his best suit, and although the evening was damp, his arthritis had been remarkably mellow, nothing but an occasional twinge. For some absurd reason, the boy had wanted him to leave his umbrella home, but Dusander had insisted. All in all, he had had a pleasant and rather exciting evening. Dreadful cognac or no, he had not been out to dinner in 9 years. During the meal, he had discussed the Essen Motor Works, the rebuilding of post-war Germany. Bowden had asked several intelligent questions about that and had seemed impressed by Dusander's answers. And German writers. Monica Bowden had asked him how he had happened to come to America so late in life, and Dusander, adopting the proper expression of myopic sorrow, had explained about the death of his fictitious wife. Monica Bowden was meltingly sympathetic. And now, over the absurd cognac, Dick Bowden said, "If this is too personal, Mr. Denker, please don't answer, but I couldn't help wondering what you did in the war." The boy stiffened ever so slightly. Dusander smiled and felt for his cigarettes. He could see them perfectly well, but it was important to make not the tiniest slip. Monica put them in his hand. "Thank you, dear lady. The meal was superb. You are a fine cook. My own wife never did better." Monica thanked him and looked flustered. Todd gave her an irritated look.
"Not personal at all," Dusander said, lighting his cigarette and turning to Bowden. "I was in the reserves from 1943 on, as were all able-bodied men too old to be in the active services. By then the handwriting was on the wall for the Third Reich and for the madmen who created it, one madman in particular, of course." He blew out his match and looked solemn. "There was great relief when the tide turned against Hitler. Great relief, of course." And here he looked at Bowden disarmingly as man to man. "One was careful not to express such a sentiment, not allowed."
"I suppose not," Dick Bowden said respectfully.
"No," Dusander said gravely, "not allowed. I remember one evening when the four or five of us, all friends, stopped at a local Ratskeller after work for a drink. By then there was not always schnapps or even beer, but it so happened that night there were both. We had all known each other for upwards of 20 years. One of our number, Hans Hassler, mentioned in passing that perhaps the Führer had been ill-advised to open a second front against the Russians. I said, 'Hans, God in heaven, watch what you say.' Poor Hans went pale and changed the subject entirely. Yet 3 days later he was gone. I never saw him again, nor, as far as I know, did anyone else who was sitting at our table that night."
"How awful," Monica said breathlessly. "More cognac, Mr. Denker?"
"No, thank you," he smiled at her. "My wife had a saying from her mother, one must never overdo the sublime."
Todd's small, troubled frown deepened slightly.
"Do you think he was sent to one of the camps?" Dick asked.
"Your friend Hassler."
"Hassler," Dusander corrected gently.
He grew grave.
"Many were. The camps, they will be the shame of the German people for 1,000 years to come. They are Hitler's real legacy."
"Oh, I think that's too harsh,"
Bowden said, lighting his pipe and puffing out a choking cloud of cherry blend. According to what I've read, the majority of the German people had no idea what was going on. The locals around Auschwitz thought it was a sausage plant.
Oh, how terrible, Monica said, and pulled a grimacing "that's enough of that" expression at her husband.
Then she turned to Dusander and smiled. I just love the smell of a pipe, Mr. Denker, don't you?
Indeed I do, madam, Dusander said. He had just gotten an almost insurmountable urge to sneeze under control.
Bowden suddenly reached across the table and clapped his son on the shoulder. Todd jumped.
You're awfully quiet tonight, son. Feeling all right?
Todd offered a peculiar smile that seemed divided between his father and Dusander.
I feel okay. I've heard most of these stories before, remember?
Todd, Monica said, that's hardly
the boy. He is only being honest, Dusander said.
A privilege of boys which men often have to give up.
Yes, Mr. Bowden?
Dick laughed and nodded.
Perhaps I could get Todd to walk back to mine house with me now, Dusander said. I'm sure he has his studies.
Todd is a very apt pupil, Monica said, but she spoke almost automatically, looking at Todd in a puzzled sort of way. All A's and B's, usually. He got a C this last quarter, but he's promised to bring his French up to snuff on his March report. Right, Todd, baby?
Todd offered the peculiar smile again and nodded.
No need for you to walk, Dick said. I'll be glad to run you back to your place.
I walk for the air and the exercise, Dusander said. Really, I must insist, unless Todd prefers not to.
Oh, no, I'd like a walk, Todd said, and his mother and father beamed at him. They were almost at Dusander's corner when Dusander broke the silence. It was drizzling, and he hoisted his umbrella over both of them. And yet, still, his arthritis lay quiet, dozing. It was amazing.
You are like my arthritis, he said.
Todd's head came up. Huh?
Neither of you have had much to say tonight. What's got your tongue, boy? Cat or cormorant?
Nothing, Todd muttered.
They turned down Dusander's street. Perhaps I could guess, Dusander said, not without a touch of malice. When you came to get me, you were afraid I might make a slip. Let the cat out of the bag, you say here. Yet you were determined to go through with the dinner because you had run out of excuses to put your parents off. Now you are disconcerted that all went well. Is that not the truth?
Who cares? Todd said, and shrugged sullenly.
Why shouldn't it go well? Dusander demanded. I was dissembling before you were born. You keep a secret well enough, I give you that. I give it to you most graciously. But did you see me tonight? I charmed them. Charmed them.
Todd suddenly burst out. You didn't have to do that.
Dusander came to a complete stop, staring at Todd. Not do it? Not? I thought that was what you wanted, boy. Certainly they will offer no objections if you continue to come over and read to me.
You're sure taking a lot for granted, Todd said hotly. Maybe I've got all I want from you. Do you think there's anybody forcing me to come over to your scuzzy house and watch you slop up booze like those old wino puss bags that hang around the old train yards? Is that what you think?
His voice had risen and taken on a thin, wavering, hysterical note. Because there's nobody forcing me. If I want to come, I'll come, and if I don't, I won't.
Lower your voice. People will hear.
Who cares?
Todd said. But he began to walk again. This time he deliberately walked outside the umbrella's span.
No, nobody forces you to come, Dusander said.
And then he took a calculated shot in the dark.
In fact, you are welcome to stay away. Believe me, boy, I have no scruples about drinking alone, none at all.
Todd looked at him scornfully. You'd like that, wouldn't you?
Dusander only smiled noncommittally. Well, don't count on it.
They had reached the concrete walk leading up to Dusander's stoop. Dusander fumbled in his pocket for his latchkey. The arthritis flared a dim red in the joints of his fingers, and then subsided, waiting. Now Dusander thought he understood what it was waiting for him to be alone again, Then it could come out. "I'll tell you something," Todd said. He sounded oddly breathless. "If they knew what you were, if I ever told them, they'd spit on you and then kick you out on your skinny old ass." Dusander looked at Todd closely in the drizzling dark. The boy's face was turned defiantly up to his, but the skin was pallid, the sockets under the eyes dark and slightly hollowed, the skin tones of someone who has brooded long while others are asleep. "I am sure they would have nothing but revulsion for me," Dusander said, although he privately thought that the elder Bowden might stay his revulsion long enough to ask many of the questions his son had asked already. "Nothing but revulsion. But what would they feel for you, boy, when I told them you had known about me for 8 months and said nothing?" Todd stared at him, wordlessly in the dark. "Come and see me if you please," Dusander said indifferently, "and stay home if you don't. Good night, boy." He went up the walk to his front door, leaving Todd standing in the drizzle and looking after him with his mouth slightly ajar. The next morning at breakfast, Monica said, "Your dad liked Mr. Denker a lot, Todd. He said he reminded him of your grandfather." Todd muttered something unintelligible around his toast. Monica looked at her son and wondered if he had been sleeping well. He looked pale, and his grades had taken that inexplicable dip. Todd never got C's. "Are you feeling okay these days, Todd?" He looked at her blankly for a moment, and then that radiant smile spread over his face, charming her, comforting her. There was a dab of strawberry preserves on his chin. "Sure," he said, 4-0. "Todd, baby," she said. "Monica, baby," he responded, and they both started to laugh. 9. March 1975. "Kitty, kitty," Dusander said. "Here, kitty, kitty. Puss, puss. Puss, puss." He was sitting on his back stoop, a pink plastic bowl by his right foot. The bowl was full of milk. It was 1:30 in the afternoon. The day was hazy and hot. Brush fires far to the west tinged the air with an autumnal smell that jagged oddly against the calendar. If the boy was coming, he would be here in another hour. But the boy didn't always come now. Instead of 7 days a week, he came sometimes only 4 times or 5. An intuition had grown in him little by little, and his intuition told him that the boy was having troubles of his own. "Kitty, kitty," Dusander coaxed. The stray cat was at the far end of the yard, sitting in the ragged verge of weeds by Dusander's fence. It was a tom, and every bit as ragged as the weeds it sat in. Every time he spoke, the cat's ears cocked forward. Its eyes never left the pink bowl filled with milk. Perhaps, Dusander thought, the boy was having troubles with his studies, or bad dreams, or both. That last made him smile. "Kitty, kitty," he called softly. The cat's ears cocked forward again. It didn't move, not yet, but it continued to study the milk. Dusander had certainly been afflicted with problems of his own. For 3 weeks or so he had worn the SS uniform to bed like grotesque pajamas, and the uniform had warded off the insomnia and the bad dreams. His sleep had been, at first, as sound as a lumberjack's. Then the dreams had returned, not little by little, but all at once and worse than ever before. Dreams of running, as well as the dreams of the eyes. Running through a wet, unseen jungle where heavy leaves and damp fronds struck his face, leaving trickles that felt like sap or blood. Running and running, the luminous eyes always around him, peering soullessly at him until he broke into a clearing. In the darkness he sensed, rather than saw, the steep rise that began on the clearing's far side. At the top of that rise was Patton, its low cement buildings and yards surrounded by barbed wire and electrified wire, its sentry towers standing like Martian dreadnoughts straight out of War of the Worlds, and in the middle huge stacks billowed smoke against the sky, and below these brick columns were the furnaces, stoked and ready to go, glowing in the night like the eyes of fierce demons. They had told the inhabitants of the area that the Patton inmates made clothes and candles, and of course the locals had believed that no more than the locals around Auschwitz had believed that the camp was a sausage factory. It didn't matter. Looking back over his shoulder in the dream, he would at last see them coming out of hiding, the restless dead, the Juden, shambling toward him with blue numbers glaring from the livid flesh of their outstretched arms, their hands hooked into talons, their faces no longer expressionless, but animated with hate, lively with vengeance, vivacious with murder. Toddlers ran beside their mothers, and grandfathers were borne up by their middle-aged children, and the dominant expression on all their faces was desperation. Desperation? Yes, because in the dreams he knew, and so did they, that if he could climb the hill, he would be safe. Down here in these wet and swampy lowlands, in this jungle where the night-flowering plants extruded blood instead of sap, he was a hunted animal, prey. But up there he was in command. If this was a jungle, then the camp at the top of the hill was a zoo. All the wild animals safely in cages, he, the head keeper, whose job it was to decide which would be fed, which would live, which would be handed over to the vivisectionists, which would be taken to the knackers in the remover's van. He would begin to run up the hill, running in all the slowness of nightmare. He would feel the first skeletal hands close about his neck, feel their cold and stinking breath, smell their decay, hear their bird-like cries of triumph as they pulled him down, with salvation not only in sight but almost at hand. "Kitty, kitty," Dusander called. "Milk, nice milk." The cat came at last. It crossed half of the backyard, and then sat again, but lightly, its tail twitching with worry. It didn't trust him, no. But Dusander knew the cat could smell the milk, and so he was sanguine. Sooner or later it would come. At Patton there had never been a contraband problem. Some of the prisoners came with their valuables poked far up their asses in small chamois bags. And how often their valuables turned out not to be valuable at all, photographs, locks of hair, fake jewelry, often pushed up with sticks until they were past the point where even the long fingers of the trusty they had called Stinky Thumbs could reach. One woman, he remembered, had had a small diamond, flawed, it turned out, really not valuable at all, but it had been in her family for 6 generations, passed from mother to eldest daughter, or so she said. But of course she was a Jew, and all of them lied. She swallowed it before entering Patton. When it came out in her waist, she swallowed it again. She kept doing this, although eventually the diamond began to cut her insides, and she bled. There had been other ruses, although most only involved petty items such as a hoard of tobacco or a hair ribbon or two. It didn't matter. In the room Dusander used for prisoner interrogations, there was a hot plate and a homely kitchen table covered with a red checked cloth, much like the one in his own kitchen. There was always a pot of lamb stew bubbling mellowly away on that hot plate. When contraband was suspected, and when was it not, a member of the suspected clique would be brought to that room. Dusander would stand them by the hot plate, where the rich fumes from the stew wafted. Gently he would ask them, "Who? Who is hiding gold? Who is hiding jewelry? Who has tobacco? Who gave the Givenet woman the pill for her baby? Who?" The stew was never specifically promised, but always the aroma eventually loosened their tongues. Of course, a truncheon would have done the same, or a gun barrel jammed into their filthy crotches, but the stew was elegant, yes. "Kitty, kitty," Dusander called. The cat's ears cocked forward. It half rose, then half remembered some long-ago kick, or perhaps a match that had burned its whiskers, and it settled back on its haunches. But soon it would move. He had found a way of propitiating his nightmare. It was, in a way, no more than wearing the SS uniform. but raised to a greater power. Dusander was pleased with himself, only sorry that he had never thought of it before. He supposed he had the boy to thank for this new method of quieting himself, for showing him that the key to the past's terrors was not in rejection, but in contemplation, and even something like a friend's embrace. It was true that before the boy's unexpected arrival last summer, he hadn't had any bad dreams for a long time. But he believed now that he had come to a coward's terms with his past. He had been forced to give up a part of himself. Now he had reclaimed it. "Kitty, kitty," called Dusander, and a smile broke on his face. A kindly smile, a reassuring smile, the smile of all old men who have somehow come through the cruel courses of life to a safe place, still relatively intact, and with at least some wisdom. The Tom rose from its haunches, hesitated only a moment longer, and then trotted across the remainder of the backyard with lithe grace. It mounted the steps, gave Dusander a final mistrustful look, laying back its chewed and scabby ears. Then it began to drink the milk. "Nice milk," Dusander said, pulling on the Playtex rubber gloves that had lain in his lap all the while. "Nice milk for a nice kitty." He had bought these gloves in the supermarket. He had stood in the express lane, and older women had looked at him approvingly, even speculatively. The gloves were advertised on TV. They had cuffs. They were so flexible, you could pick up a dime while you were wearing them. He stroked the cat's back with one green finger and talked to it soothingly. Its back began to arch with the rhythm of his strokes. Just before the bowl was empty, he seized the cat. It came electrically alive in his clenching hands, twisting and jerking, clawing at the rubber. Its body lashed limberly back and forth, and Dusander had no doubt that if its teeth or claws got into him, it would come off the winner. It was an old campaigner. It takes one to know one, Dusander thought, grinning. Holding the cat prudently away from his body, the painful grin stamped on his face, Dusander pushed the back door open with his foot and went into the kitchen. The cat yowled and twisted and ripped at the rubber gloves. Its feral, triangular head flashed down and fastened on one green thumb. "Nasty kitty," Dusander said reproachfully. The oven door stood open. Dusander threw the cat inside. Its claws made a ripping, prickly sound as they disengaged from the gloves. Dusander slammed the oven door shut with one knee, provoking a painful twinge from his arthritis. Yet he continued to grin. Breathing hard, nearly panting, he propped himself against the stove for a moment, his head hanging down. It was a gas stove. He rarely used it for anything fancier than TV dinners and killing stray cats. Faintly, rising up through the gas burners, he could hear the cat scratching and yowling to be let out. Dusander twisted the oven dial over to 500 degrees. There was an audible pop as the oven pilot light lit two double rows of hissing gas. The cat stopped yowling and began to scream. It sounded, yes, almost like a young boy in terrible pain. The thought made Dusander smile even more broadly. His heart thundered in his chest. The cat scratched and whirled madly in the oven, still screaming. Soon a hot, furry, burning smell began to seep out of the oven and into the room. He scraped the remains of the cat out of the oven half an hour later. Using a barbecue fork he had acquired for $2.98 at the Grants in the shopping center a mile away. The cat's roasted carcass went into an empty flour sack. He took the sack down cellar. The cellar floor had never been cemented. Shortly, Dusander came back up. He sprayed the kitchen with Glade until it reeked of artificial pine scent. He opened all the windows. He washed the barbecue fork and hung it up on the pegboard. Then he sat down to wait and see if the boy would come. He smiled and smiled. Todd did come, about 5 minutes after Dusander had given up on him for the afternoon. He was wearing a warm-up jacket with his school colors on it. He was also wearing a San Diego Padres baseball cap. He carried his school books under his arms. Yucca ducca, he said, coming into the kitchen and wrinkling his nose. What's that smell? It's awful.
I tried the oven, Dusander said, lighting a cigarette. I'm afraid I burned my supper. I had to throw it out.
One day later that month, the boy came much earlier than usual, long before school usually let out. Dusander was sitting in the kitchen, drinking ancient-age bourbon from a chipped and discolored cup that had the words, "Here's your coffee, ma, ha, ha, ha," written around the rim. He had his rocker out in the kitchen now, and he was just drinking and rocking, rocking and drinking, bumping his slippers on the faded linoleum. He was pleasantly high. There had been no more bad dreams at all until just last night, not since the tomcat with the chewed ears. Last night's had been particularly horrible, though. That could not be denied. They had dragged him down after he had gotten halfway up the hill, and they had begun to do unspeakable things to him before he was able to wake himself up. Yet after his initial thrashing return to the world of real things, he had been confident. He could end the dreams whenever he wished. Perhaps a cat would not be enough this time, but there was always the dog pound. Yes, always the pound. Todd came abruptly into the kitchen, his face pale and shiny and strained. He had lost weight, all right, Dusander thought, and there was a queer white look in his eyes that Dusander did not like at all. You're going to help me, Todd said suddenly and defiantly. Really? Dusander said mildly, but sudden apprehension leaped inside of him. He didn't let his face change as Todd slammed his books down on the table with a sudden, vicious overhand stroke. One of them spun, skated across the oilcloth, and landed in a tent on the floor by Dusander's foot. "Yes, you're fucking a right," Todd said shrilly. "You better believe it, because this is your fault. All your fault." Hectic spots of red mounted into his cheeks. "But you're going to have to help me get out of it, because I've got the goods on you. I've got you right where I want you."
"I'll help you in any way I can," Dusander said quietly. He saw that he had folded his hands neatly in front of himself without even thinking about it, just as he had once done. He leaned forward in the rocker until his chin was directly over his folded hands, as he had once done. His face was calm and friendly and inquiring. None of his growing apprehension showed. Sitting just so, he could almost imagine a pot of lamb stew simmering on the stove behind him. "Tell me what the trouble is."
"This is the fucking trouble," Todd said viciously and threw a folder at Dusander. It bounced off his chest and landed in his lap, and he was momentarily surprised by the heat of the anger which leaped up in him, the urge to rise and backhand the boy smartly. Instead, he kept the mild expression on his face. It was the boy's school card, he saw, although the school seemed to be at ridiculous pains to hide the fact. Instead of a school card or a grade report, it was called a quarterly progress report. He grunted at that and opened the card. A typed half-sheet of paper fell out. Dusander put it aside for later examination and turned his attention to the boy's grades first.
"You seem to have fallen on the rocks, my boy," Dusander said, not without some pleasure. The boy had passed only English and American history. Every other grade was an F.
"It's not my fault," Todd hissed venomously. "It's your fault. All those stories. I have nightmares about them, do you know that? I sit down and open my books and I start thinking about whatever you told me that day, and the next thing I know, my mother's telling me it's time to go to bed. Well, that's not my fault. It isn't. You hear me? It isn't."
"I hear you very well," Dusander said, and read the typed note that had been tucked into Todd's card.